Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Hello, everyone. Today, it is my pleasure to speak to Sid Mahasip about measuring and improving performance of a founder, their teams, and their startup as the result. Sid is a published author, serial entrepreneur, venture investor, university professor, board member, business thought leader, and public speaker. That's a lot of hats. Sid founded and led several early age and hyper-growth companies from inception to acquisition. As a professional fund manager and angel investor, Sid has mentored dozens of entrepreneurs, met with hundreds of startup companies, and reviewed countless of business plans. Sid is the author of the book, The Caterpillar Edge, Evolve, Evolve Again, and Thrive in Business. Welcome to the show, Sid.
Thank you so much. Good to be with you, Natalie.
Now, tell us, how did you get started coaching startup founders?
Well, I don't think I planned for it. I just fell into it. I've been an entrepreneur myself, built a number of companies. And as I started investing, I found that I have a much higher rate of return if I stay close to the entrepreneurs and help guide them. Also, obviously, I learned early that as an entrepreneur, if I listen to others and see how they've done things and so forth, it would be a good thing to do. So just paying forward, as you would say.
In your book, you say, don't leave change to chance in business and in life. Can you share with us how can you take charge of making this change?
The key thing is that we have this, we all do. This is not, some of us, all of us have certain addictions to past and what I call sameness. We're comfortable with certain routines. We get up the same time. We do the same thing because it's comfortable for us. So whenever change comes, it's uncomfortable. And if we don't take control of it, what we've basically done, we've left it to probability and chance, hoping that it would work in our favor. So when I say don't leave change to chance, it's change is here. Change will happen. The whole world around us, and it's actually gaining a lot more speed in the past decade or so because of technology, because of people's expectations, both the customers and the employees and the society. So it's coming at a much faster rate, and innovation is coming from all over the globe. So since it's coming faster, what happens if we're stuck in our addictions, in our sameness? It will impact us that much harder, and it would be harder for us to then manage change. One of those things that I'm kind of against these days is this idea of managing change. Change cannot be managed. It has to be embraced. It has to be even made, ignited. We are in control of that change, then we have a better chance of tilting the probability of success in our favor. So that's why I say don't leave change to chance. And part of that not leaving change to chance is being able to evolve for us to be our next best version, because the old version, which had all the addictions and biases, is not necessarily the best version that could deal with all the new challenges in the world.
Very interesting. So what you just said is do not stay in the comfortable zone. And I completely agree that we really only grow when we become uncomfortable. The growth only happens in the zone where we are uncomfortable. And
absolutely,
it is so hard, but the people I feel like that are willing to embrace this being uncomfortable are the people who are actually growing. And if
absolutely,
we're staying where we are, then we're comfortable and we do not really grow.
It's like water. If you have water to stay still at the same place, it then begins to smell and it begins to rotten. It's although water is fluid and clear and wonderful, if it stays still, it becomes not so wonderful. One of the things that I actually did an article inspired by a 14-year-old girl that was talking to his father and her, and she said, "Well, I'm having a." She was doing singing the national anthem at a football game at high school, and she says, "I'm a little nervous, but that's good." I said, "What do you mean?" She says, "It's good because when we're nervous, we're pushing ourselves to our limit. That's different than being fearful. If you're not nervous, that means you are operating within your comfortable zone. If you're out of your comfort zone, if you're pushing yourself, you got to be nervous. And that's different than being excited. Excited is, hey, this is something new. I'm excited about it. Get excited after you've accomplished. But you got to be a little nervous. Otherwise, you're not pushing your limits."
We'll be talking about three big pieces. We'll talk about the founders, the performance of the founders, their teams, and their startups. And that's a lot to cover. But I suggest let's start with the areas where founders can improve themselves, because this is where everything starts, right? I see that so many founders and their teams have hidden potential in productivity, in efficiency, and as a result, in performance. The biggest problem is that the founders often completely miss it. They claim that there's a lack of traffic, lack of leads, there's not enough demos that we are booking, and that's where we're not growing. But in a lot of cases, that's not the case, right? What's your experience with this?
Well, this is a big topic. The reason it's big is because it probably have a few dozen answers. There's a few things that I gotta have to explain first. One is I'm not a believer in how-tos. That is, there is no book that I can give you and say, here's how to do A, B, C, and D. If you look at all the great entrepreneurs, look at Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Richard Branson's, and even going back to Henry Ford and all the big players. None of them are the same. They're very different. So this is different than cooking a dish that you say, hey, add so much salt and so much of this and a pound of meat and this, and boom, you've got it. You have to build your own philosophy of operating things, which means the way you operate, the way you measure, the way you grow, the way you evolve is very different than the other guys. Now, are there things to learn? Absolutely. But they're not how-tos. They are things to consider when you cook your own dish. You become your own great chef. So you have to understand the ingredients, which is important. The other thing is that leadership is situational. That is, the people you lead are different, the situation you lead them under are different, depending on what kind of environment they come from is different, depending on where you come from is different, depending on what the early stage or late stage company is, it makes them different. So if you have a B2C environment with something that you need to get people on board and you have recurring revenues of some sort, that's a different business than if you are doing a B2B and your salespeople have to build relationships. Those are two different environments. So there's nothing wrong with understanding different perspectives, but don't look for a prescription. So that's just maybe a qualifier before we start. Now, the founders have to realize that relevance is key. That is, if they're not selling, there is no relevance of your product. That is, what people are hearing, whether it's viral, whether it's your marketing, whether it's your sales guy, whether it's the actual product, something is not resonating with them. There is an exchange. You give me money, you give me something, and I'll give you a product or a service. So the problem is often in this idea of relevancy. It could be market relevance. It could be particular region relevance. It could be your message relevance. It's relevance that doesn't resonate with the people who have to create that exchange with you. A lot of times I've seen this idea that they have that I call founderitis. It's kind of like arthritis, but the founders get it. It's, they like this thing that they have done. They think this is the best thing. I've created this wonderful thing. These idiots, how come they don't understand what this is? Well, those idiots are actually who pays for the business. So they fall in love with what they have built. They've worked hard at it. Hey, I'll be honest. I've done this. So it's you get into this loop of how come they're not doing it, and you're just maybe adding a few features here. You go back to what you're good at, and you forget that, hey, it's not relevant. If it's not relevant, it doesn't matter if it has another feature to it. I was running an angel group, and I was seeing somewhere around 12 to 1,300 business plans every year. And I was speaking to about 400 to 450 entrepreneurs one-on-one, discussion about their business every year. I have never seen in all of my years any business that the same business plan they started with ended up being the one that won. Never. So this idea of flexibility, fungibility, and this again goes to that evolve conversation. That is, hey, this is the value proposition I started the journey with. Where should I go in order to make it relevant? How should I evolve it into something that would have value to people? At the end, again, it's that exchange. You have to deliver some value. People have to see that value and value it at a certain price for there to be a transaction. And when I say transaction, it's not necessarily a transaction of money. So if you go to Google, you push something and you get something back, in 8 seconds, you're satisfied. That may not be the right answer for you when you search that thing, but you're satisfied. There was a transaction. You clicked on you typed a word, you searched for something, that very quickly Google gave you something back. It made you happy. Now, for that, you give them the opportunity to push you a lot of advertising. So when I talk about transactions and exchange, it may not be necessarily in an economic terms. It could be a psychological terms. It could be something that satisfies you. It could be the experience. For example, if you go to Starbucks, part of that experience that you sit there, you visit with your friends, you work on your laptop is part of that value proposition, part of that exchange. And for that privilege, you're willing to pay $4 for a 50 cents cup of coffee. So there's a lot of things around the founders, the value proposition, how you need to evolve that makes them successful. Now, there's another thing that we have to consider, and that is we generally have control of the middle. That's what I mean. That is, there is a top, which is revenue. Revenue is if there is that exchange and people would buy. And there is a bottom, which is profit. But what we control as entrepreneurs is really the middle. Here's what I mean. I can't put a gun to your head and say you have to buy this. The middle is how I structure my marketing, my sales, how I design my products, how I do all the, how I control my operations, my facility cost, my people cost, my commission structure, how I produce something, how I deal with partners to get a better deal, how it's all of that is in the middle. On the top, you have the revenue, and on the bottom, you have the profit. And whatever I do in the middle impacts the top, which then translates to if there's a profit at the bottom. Now, the middle is a lot of cost items. It's how I run my administrative and processes. And that's where performance comes in. Mm-hmm. Performance is in the middle. Here's another problem. The problem is that we define the KPIs or the key performance indicators in a way that is too late to do anything with it, or we have too much of it. So here's a KPI. How much did we sell per quarter? Hey, by the time it gets to the end of the quarter, it's done. The damage is done. What's the point?
So that there is a difference between leading KPIs and lagging KPIs, right? So we need to make sure that we as founders measure both of those.
The lagging, I don't particularly care because it's happened. If I'm running it, I'm running a company, this is what's happening. I don't want to know how I did 17 years ago. Who cares? Now, do I learn from it? Of course. What I want to measure is what am I doing now? Because I'm evolving now. The world is around me today, not 3 months ago. And by the way, if we assume that the future is an extension of the past, we would still be riding horses. The future is not necessarily an extension of the past. The future is what you make it.
So then what KPIs would you suggest that startups start measuring?
It depends on the business. My point is that there's two extents, by the way. I've seen the other extent is that people who say, oh, KPIs are important, now all of a sudden they measure everything. And now they have so many different measurements that they are lost in numbers. No team, no group, no should have more than 3 or 4 KPIs because then they're lost in it. And one of them has to be shared. One of them has to be shared. So let me give you an example. If our sales is a function of the number of salespeople out there, and then it's a function of or how many phone calls we make, because our conversion is X, Y, and Z on a call, then what I really want to know is the conversion, not the sales. Because if I control the conversion, the sales would change.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if it's not, then I look at what is in between in terms of the processes that's broken, that's not doing that. Right? Because if I just see the end result 3-4 months down the road, I don't know what didn't work. I don't know if it was the people. I don't know if it was the process. I don't know if it was the script of that call that we made to somebody. I don't know if the value exchange or the product doesn't work. I just know something didn't work. And even if it worked, I don't know what worked.
For startups to grow fast, the founders also need to grow fast or with it. So going back to the founder and the performance of the founder, what is the difference between a high-performing founder versus not-so-much-performing founder?
The entrepreneur has to grow faster than the business. Here's the reason. As an entrepreneur, to be successful, particularly when it gets to hyper-growth, you have to not only live in today, you have to live in tomorrow, simultaneously.
Mm.
That means you can't sit and kind of imagine, what is the world tomorrow, and ignore the processing and the day-to-day execution today. But at the same time, if you're just focused on execution today and not see what's going on tomorrow, you're going to miss that relevance that we talked about, because you may not be relevant tomorrow if you just do this. Because the world is changing around you. So as an entrepreneur, you have to live in both places, today and tomorrow. And you have to be able to balance them. That means you have to grow faster than your business. So I love something I read recently from Jeff Bezos. In his, he has an annual letter that he writes, and he says, when companies scale, he says they also have to scale in risk. They have to have the appetite to do bigger things. Because if the business is bigger, they have to be able to, it's harder to have incremental things. If you go from $1 to $2 in sales, I call that hyper growth. But when you have a 10 million and you grow by $1, that's not hyper growth. So it's relative. So hypergrowth is relative, so is risk, so is the appetite of being able to manage things, and so is the appetite of being flexible and growing and evolving. You got to do it faster than the business. So you said, what is the difference between a hyper-growth business and a
non-hyper-growth? High-performance founder and not and
a high-performance founder. High-performance is when you are a balanced entrepreneur, meaning you're pushing all the envelopes simultaneously. Performing founders are able to create trust.
With who?
With everybody. With their people who are following them. If you're, let's go early stage where you have to raise money, and you want people to come and join your team, join a dream, join a cause, without you having a lot of money to give them, why would they come? Because they trust you, they trust your vision. Why would any investor invest in you? Because they trust you, because they trust your vision. Why would anybody buy your product? Because they trust it works.
So what are some specific tips you can give to founders for them to start measuring their performance, their team's performance, and their startup performance?
Okay. So key things. Pick something first that goes across the entire organization. That is, I call that the key metrics. It's one thing. Okay, that connects everybody together. I'll give you an example. For example, if you have a finance or an accounting department, they have different metrics that you have. They have to, you know, how much they collect, how fast they collect, how much they pay, payables, receivables, blah 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 blah. Right? But at the end, they have an element that is how much we're investing every month, or cash flow, whatever that number may be. Then you have the sales guys, and they have other things. How many did we close, the closing ratio, the number of calls. But at the end, it is cash flow that connects them to the financing department. So if we take everything in the operation, there is one component that connects all the pieces together. This may be the number of things we sold. This could be the number of visitors that come visit our site and click on something. This could be a conversion rate. It's, if we have this KPI right, everything would work. Now, the reason I'm saying that is so that we are connecting like a glue the organization together. Because otherwise, here's what happens. As the organization gets bigger, I'm the boss of this, you're the boss of that, and we're managing two different things. So I'm pushing this way, you're pushing that way. Most of the time, this happens in between marketing and sales. Marketing says, here's a lead, I brought you all these leads, and sales says, these are horrible leads, I can't close these leads. And they say, no, you told me you wanted these kind of people, I brought you this kind of people, it's your job to close them. So if we can create things that, if I'm measuring you and your compensation and your success is measured by this, your counterpart in a different department or a different thing is also have a component that is measured by the same thing. So now I've connected everybody's success through a KPI. Now, here's another trick in performance that I have learned it works. Expect 80%. Demand 120%. So from the organization, we're demanding 120% efficiency, effectiveness, growth, whatever you want to call it. But the reality is they're not you.
So then would you say that start with setting up an achievable, measurable goal for
yes.
the team, for the team to be a high-performing team?
Correct. So it's not how many you do, it's whatever you said you do.
I see so many founders, for example, they don't understand marketing. And then they hire a marketer and they say, hey, Jane, now you are the marketer, go get me some leads and you know, make this business work.
Yep.
And in the end, this lady doesn't know, she's doing what she thinks is best. And then when the founder doesn't have this connection or doesn't check where she is she on the right track? No, we have tried this and this has not worked. This is how we tried. Maybe you can do it differently, but basically give all this information. So when the founder is not in touch with this person, does not understand what this person is doing, then there's definitely going to be a problem there.
Exactly right.
What about accountability? We have not touched this, but that's also a big subject. Accountability for the founder, for the team. And by the way, that needs to be also set up by the founder, right? Being accountable for the team. What is it for you?
It's accountability is also an element of trust. Now, I say there's a three-way trust. It's not a two-way trust. First, I have to trust you as my employee. I have to invest trust in you. So I unleash your power of execution and abilities. Then you have to trust in me because I'm asking you to follow me. But both of those starts from a different place. I have to first trust me. I have to trust so that I can be confident in what I say. I have the ability to then, based on trust, believe that even if I'm wrong.
That's so interesting. So there is a three-way trust.
There is a three-way trust.
First one is trust in myself, and then for me to trust the employee, and then for employee to trust back.
Correct. So that trust in yourself also comes from competence. From the same thing we were talking about a minute ago, that if you're not knowledgeable, if you're not competent, if you don't feel you know sales or whatever, you're going to wing it. And you know what? They know you're winging it. So then you lose trust because you don't trust yourself. You don't trust them, and they won't trust you. Now, as a part of that comes accountability. That is, if I want them to trust me, I have to be accountable to them. I want to keep you accountable for what you do. So you should keep me accountable for what I do because we're a team. Otherwise, that's not a team. And we see a lot of businesses work that way, but they have limited growth potential because after a point, it's broken. When you're early stage, that person who came in and joined you is your investor because that person is investing their time, their effort, their energy, their intelligence, all of that in you. So you're responsible and accountable to them. You're not only accountable to them, you're accountable to their families. The same accountability then is linked to the KPIs that we were discussing. So if I have things that is connecting us together, we could be accountable.
So then how do founders know who to hire if they only spend an hour to a couple of hours with them without
that
being
through those
problems?
That is the biggest problem in early stage. That is the biggest problem in early stage. Some would go hire their beer drinking buddy and they fail because they could have a beer or they could talk. They think that's the right guy for the job. Well, not necessarily so. If I like somebody, that doesn't necessarily mean that person is good. If you go to war, you don't want somebody nice. You want somebody competent. So that hiring is one of the most difficult things, particularly when you're early stage and you don't have money to give people. They have to trust you. They have to believe in you.
Earlier, you and I talked a little bit about the problems that you see startup founders face when building and growing their teams, and you've brought up three problems. The product fascination and feature trap, and the perfection trap, and I really liked your analogy of the five-year-old soccer game syndrome. Talk a little bit about those.
Now there's another fascination that I've seen. Because of these books that people read, these how-to books, it's the minimum viable MVP product, the minimum viable product. I've seen people say, oh, we've got to go for the MVP, the minimum viable product. And the way they define it is, this is what we can do within the resources that we have. We can build this. Well, this doesn't have any value out there. Who cares? The viable is gone. Minimum viable, when we say minimum viable, it means viable for the client, for the customer, not viable for you. Not because you don't have two engineers and you have one engineer and you can't deliver this feature set. It has to be viable to them.
I find that so many founders just, they want their idea to work. And that's why they keep working, adding new features, adding new this and that, because they don't want to face the truth that if right now with where you are in your product development, people don't need that, then even if you are going to add five more features in a year, for example, people may still not need it, right? And it's so hard to face the truth that, hey, people don't need it. That's why it's easier, especially for tech founders, the developers, to keep working on that instead of facing the truth that, yes, people may not need it.
Yeah, You're exactly right. Part of that is just like people who go get a PhD, a lot of times they're very good at studying because the parameter of success is pretty well known. I read this book. I know the test looks like this. They know what success looks like. This is how I do these four things and I succeed. When you hit the market, they decide what success is, not you. And it is not defined. It is undefined. There is no parameter that you say, if I have these three things, they definitely would have it. If I answer these three questions, I get an A. It doesn't work like that. So because the definition of a win is kind of cloudy, a lot of people, founders, particularly with a technology background, get nervous. They don't want to cross it. I am in control of these features. I am not in control if the customer doesn't like it. If they don't like it, they're an idiot. I got a perfect A in having these features done on time, and they look perfect. So it is a different set of people that are evaluating you, that are grading you. They don't have a criteria that you're familiar with. One other thing that you mentioned that I think is interesting is the idea of the 5-year-old soccer games, and this I see a lot of times.
I have a 4-year-old, so that's why who's playing soccer, so that's why it's really vivid in my mind.
Yeah, so if you've looked at the kids playing soccer, when the ball goes in a different direction, all 9, 10, 11 people just follow the ball. So you see it. They go all the way across, they go in the back, they go in the forward, they go in the back, and go. This happens a lot in early stage companies. There is an excuse. They say, we don't have, this is an important thing, so everybody has to focus on it. Oh, okay. We don't have enough people, so we have to solve this problem. But it is the exact wrong thing to do. Because while everybody is following this ball, these other things over here are completely open for and vulnerable and unattended to. It could be the customers, it could be other technology, it could be all the other stuff that's there. And then now we're running from one place to another. Everybody runs to this place, now the ball went here. Okay, now everybody else runs. We have a lot of half-done stuff. And then we are overwhelmed. Then we work 16 or 18 hours with a bunch of stuff that's all half done. So this problem occurs quite a bit.
It's really great talking to you about this. We are running out of time a little bit. So what's the one last thing that you see is very common among all of the founders that you work with that you kind of want to share with other founders so that they don't either don't make the same mistake, for example, or maybe they miss something? They do need to look into another area of opportunity. What's the one thing?
The one thing is the idea of fear. So we're all afraid. We're all afraid in one way or another. We're afraid of not succeeding. We're afraid of succeeding. Now, if we look at fear and we look at what drives it, it's usually knowledge that drives fear, the lack of knowledge. That is, if I'm afraid of something, if I don't know that something, or if I don't know the cure to that something, if I don't know how to deal with that something, then I'm afraid of it. And the idea of not being afraid is not a good idea. It's not that you have to kill fear. Courage is not the opposite of fear. Courage is the ability to cross fear. That is, we're all afraid. If we're not afraid, we won't win. That means we're not pushing, we're not doing anything. Going back to your idea of originally about this idea that if we don't get out of the sameness. So this idea of competency, of knowledge, of us being able to push through things is important. Now, failure is now being pushed as this fail fast idea. Fail fast, fail often. Don't fail fast. This is my advice. Don't fail fast. Learn fast. Nobody wants to fail. Learn fast means get the knowledge so that you overcome the fear.
One thing I wanted to share with the founders is I find that lack of action is a big area of opportunity. How smart you are, how good your idea is, what you've done in the past, or even who you know, none of this entitles you to be successful in your startup or in life. It's only if it's backed up by action. And I see so many founders lack this action, maybe because they're afraid of something. Maybe they are afraid of doing something or, you know, failing. And in the beginning, I think the mindset needs to be that there will be failures for sure, especially if this is your first, second, third, fifth startup, there will be failures. Expect them. And if nothing like this happens, then great. But majority of founders fail in the first, second, and third startup, and they learn on those mistakes. So the idea of learning fast is exactly where I'm leading, that you need to learn from all of those mistakes.
That's correct. We have to differentiate between a failure and a mistake. They're different. The way I define them. A mistake is when you fail and you don't learn. Then you made a mistake. When you fail and you learn, that's not a mistake. That's an experiment. It's different.
That's very
interesting. If I learn from something I've failed on, then I have gained experience. I have experimented something. A mistake only happens if I don't learn from it. Then you can regret it. But you can't regret a failure that you learn out of.
And that's an experiment. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Svit, for all of your wisdom.
My pleasure.
Where can founders read a little bit more about you?
The best place would be my site, mohasseb.com, which is M-O-H-A-S-S-E-B, like my name, .com. And then there's a bunch of things there. You know, there's a link that goes to my advisory activities, a link that goes to my venture investment advice, and a link that goes to my speaker activities.
Sounds good. I thank you so much, Svit, for all your time, and we'll chat again soon.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
That's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to the SaaS Boss Show. If you found this content interesting, I'd really appreciate it if you take just a second to leave a review on iTunes so that founders just like you can learn about this show. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, and I'll be back with another interview next week.